Hello, everybody, and welcome to the season finale of Uncork the Sun with the Vinstitute Wine School. I'm your host, Moss Scherkogel. That's it. Just Moss Scherkogel. I've had a very fun time recording this podcast series, but it is time now for the show to go dormant for the winter. We picked the grapes, and now it's time to douse this whole thing in water and let it freeze. If you don't understand what I just said, then what are you doing listening to the last episode? Go back to episode 5 and catch up. Jeez. I've had the opportunity throughout this show to speak about a lot of subjects in wine that I find very interesting, and I've been able to chat with some great characters in the wine industry. Today, to wrap things up, I have an interview that I recorded with Ted Kane, the owner, winemaker, and vineyard manager of Riverstone Estate Winery. Ted is a very knowledgeable and talented winemaker, and a lot of that knowledge has come from his own independent drive to learn about the science of oenology and viticulture, that is to say, winemaking and grape growing. Coming from Alberta, Ted used to drive over the Rocky Mountains to buy Okanagan grapes in the fall. He would load up his hatchback to the brim with Merlot or whatever he could get his hands on, and putter back up over the snowy passes so that he could make his own wine in his basement. Eventually, or so I understand, his wife Lorraine intervened and demanded that they just move to BC and plant their own vineyard. That was the birth of Riverstone Estate Winery, so named for the creek bed rocks that Ted planted his vineyard on. Riverstone's located to the northeast of the town of Oliver in a wonderfully fertile spot for growing grapes. As I was speaking to Ted, he was actually right in the midst of the 2020 harvest, having picked the very first of his white wine grapes already. I'll let him tell you the rest of the details in our interview, but being mid-harvest was definitely one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to Ted for this episode. Now, there's one thing I want to mention before we continue. Riverstone has very graciously offered to provide a coupon code to any listeners of this podcast who would like to order wine online from them. During the times of COVID, small wineries have been struggling with the ever-rising cost of shipping packages. It can very easily cost $30 or $40 to ship just one case of wine within British Columbia, and more than that, even just within BC for any destinations that are off the beaten path. You want to ship something to Salt Spring Island with one of the major couriers? It's an extra $15 on top of those fees just to get out there. With all that said, though, Riverstone is offering free shipping to listeners of this podcast for any purchase of 6 bottles or more from their online store. So pop on over to their website and use the coupon code UNCORK. One word, all uppercase. Do that and you will pay nothing for shipping, which can save a whole lot of money on some really excellent wine. Now then, let's move on to the interview that I conducted with Ted Kane of Riverstone Estate Winery earlier this week. Would you mind, Ted, just stating your full name and your job title?
Okay. My name is Ted Kane, and I'm the owner, winemaker, and vineyard manager at Riverstone Estate Winery in Oliver, British Columbia.
Well, hi, Ted.
Good morning.
Ted, quick question. You say winemaker and vineyard manager. I've heard, you know, a dozen different terms used for those jobs, vintner or viticulturalist. Could you explain why you use the terms that you do?
I think the terms are really interchangeable. Sometime you might catch me using some of those other terms. Sometimes I'll use the terms I did. I think it all comes from, starting the property from nothing. Cactuses and sagebrush when I got here in 2001. Developing the land with the wells, irrigation infrastructure, and planting in 2003. And so I know the vineyard from the ground up, and I'm managing the vineyard in a direction that will help me produce the wines that I want to produce, which are, you know, terroir-driven wines, really respective of the soils and the climate.
So you think manager is more of an accurate, more of a holistic look at all the things that you have to do?
Yeah, I think so. I try to keep up on reading with day-to-day advances in viticulture. And when I'm stumped by Mother Nature, I look into it in books and magazines and articles. So in a way, I suppose a viticulturalist.
I've actually discussed with you in the past terminology when we were talking about some of your red blend wines. I remember discussing with you the term Meritage and Bordeaux style blend and how those are used and in what ways those are used. And your red blends are not deemed as Meritage. You don't buy into that exact term. Could you just remind me, you know, what your motivation was behind naming those and what your thought process was?
2 seconds that my dog's barking. I just got to let him in. 2 seconds.
That's right. Yeah, my children are playing just on the other side of the very thin door right next to me. So
my thin door lets in the barking. So Meritage, which is also interchangeable, I believe, you know, with Bordeaux style or Bordeaux, but it's a term that the Americans have coined, and you can use that name if you want to. You have to pay for it. And Bordeaux, of course, unless you live in Bordeaux, you cannot use that name, but you can say Bordeaux style. To me, you know, when I say Bordeaux style, if you know, people know which varietals I'm talking about. It's those reds that the French figured out a long time ago that seem to go so well together in a climate that can not always be consistent, variable. Merlot, Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Malbec, Petit Verdot. You can get different qualities and characteristics that can enhance a season. And so the blending of those in any season can really make or break the wines. You're not dependent upon all of them ripening fully. Mm-hmm. And growing in Canada, cool climate, I think that's important.
When you put together your red blends, is there some level of consistency from year to year in terms of the recipe, the ratio? Or do you ever have wild variations?
I think it's relatively consistent. It all started out when I conceived of my vineyard in British Columbia when I was sitting in Alberta in the cold of winter, and I was thinking about what is a Bordeaux style blend contain and what can you do in Canada. And I had learned that Merlot is much more of a consistent ripening grape within the limitations of our season. And so a right bank red wine blend is probably more the better way to go. So that's kind of how it all started out. And then when I'm blending, you know, I planted the vineyard with Merlot as dominant, and then Cabernet Sauvignon came in next, Cabernet Franc, Malbec, and then a little bit of Petit Verdot. And, you know, I have to say now that if I was planting all over again, I might change up that ratio a little bit. I've learned a few things over the years and what's a winner and what's, you know, harder to grow and whatnot. But I still think Merlot is just a star and one of my favorite grapes to grow. And it's a real noble variety.
Rightly so that it's the most planted grape in British Columbia, I think.
I agree.
Yeah. Now, I just want to ask you quickly about Petit Verdot, because you have some of that in your vineyard and you are one of few. There is not much of it in the province.
You know, I actually don't mind growing it at all. The amount I grow is quite manageable. You know, when you're growing grapevines, when you learn about growing them and how they behave, I could pick a grape that grows up a little bit more straight up and down. And you know, Petit Verdot loves to lie down. Mm-hmm. It also loves to crop too many bunches per shoot. So it takes fairly intensive management. But if you manage it well, you can produce some really nice ripe grapes easily within our season. And it really adds to a blend. And, you know, I wish I grew more so I could do more of a single varietal out of it.
Mm. Now, in terms of the overall scale of your winery, what is the size of your planted vineyard?
So our primary piece of land and primary vineyard, which I call River Rock Vineyard, is 9.5 acres with about a little over 7 acres in vines. Mm-hmm. And just recently, as of last February, we took possession of another piece of land that lies adjacent, which is another 10 acres with just a little around 8 acres in vines as well, which will fully come into production as far as the wines over a series of the next 4 or 5 years, I'd say.
That's a huge upgrade. I mean, that's doubling potential production. That's big. How do you feel about suddenly having to take on, you know, 100% more in terms of vineyard operation?
Well, it's been a very busy summer with all work and less play. You know, I'm excited about the future, but yeah, it's a lot of work. I've got good people to help me. And for me with Riverstone, I always say it's about the team. And I've put together a really great team. I'm hoping for great things from them.
Hmm. How many cases of production do you turn out per year?
Currently, we're putting out 4,300.
4,300.
Yeah, but I am purchasing some fruit from a couple of local growers as well.
And so is the idea that with the new vineyard, you'll be able to have everything under your own umbrella, or do you imagine that you'll still be purchasing a little bit of fruit?
We'll see with time. What's growing on my other property isn't the grapes that I'm purchasing right now.
Right.
So as you know, the changeover from a vineyard will take approximately 3 years, provided I can get the grape stock that I want to plant. But ideally, hopefully, I would love to be able to do that. I would love to grow absolutely everything that I make wine from. Hmm.
The new property, did it have planted vines already? Was it grapevines, or are you planting fresh?
No, the vineyard was planted to Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Syrah, and Viognier. Some of those I grow already myself, and some of them I don't, but I'm looking forward to playing around with those grapes and some new wines possibly as well. Right now, one of the grape varietals that I'd love to put in over there is Malbec, and I'm finding out about getting plants. Malbec are one of the varietals that some of the bigger companies are taking a great interest in. And so it's going to be a little bit tough to possibly get some of that, I'm finding. However, I've had a little bit of experience with grafting. I've done some grafting in this vineyard with good success, but it takes a lot of care and attention and babysitting once you do the grafting. Check in next year and I'll let you know how it goes.
Okay. We've talked a little bit on this podcast before about planting vines and grafting vines, but I kind of hand waved all the logistics of actually getting your hands on the vines. Just said, well, you get your vines and then you plant them. But I never really explained whether that was a potential issue. Are there supply concerns when you have a lot of people hungry for a certain grape like Malbec?
I would say yes. Back in 2003, when I bought my Malbec for the current property is planting, it came from France. And I can still get vines from France. Most of vines will come from nurseries in Eastern Canada, but also people are pulling from nurseries in the United States as well. It's unfortunately, there's right now, it all depends on what's hot. And I believe that Malbec is going to be perceived as hot coming up here, or it already is. I knew it a long time ago, but they're just learning it now.
There you go. So right now, it's September 20th when we're recording this, Ted. And the reason that I wanted to talk to you specifically today is because you're right in the middle of your harvest, aren't you?
Yeah, we've started our harvest now. And we've brought in some of the whites. We're still going to be waiting on our reds for a period of time, but rosé season is quickly approaching as well. Yeah, we're in the middle of it.
So tell me, what have you already picked so far specifically?
Well, we've brought in Sauvignon Blanc and Gewurztraminer, and our Pinot Gris will probably be picked later this week.
Right. And again, this is something else that I've talked about on the podcast before about the concept of harvesting. In your own words, as somebody who's in the trenches, how do you evaluate when your fruit is ready to pick? What are the considerations you have to take in?
Well, during the season, I'm trying to walk the vineyard as much as possible, looking at development and doing all the things that Mother Nature wants us to do to keep up with highest possible quality, pulling leaves at the right time and giving the right sun exposure and protecting the vines from disease, mildew, any rots, things like that. So as it gets closer to harvest dates, I'll start to draw berry samples along with tasting, and I'll get myself an idea of where my sugar's at and where my acids are at. Once they reach a certain point of maturity, the acids will start to fall and the sugar can continue to climb. It's kind of nice to get a nice balance and flavors of utmost importance. So I'll taste and I'll measure and I'll watch for maturity. Maturity being sort of the lignification of the stems, and then seed maturity and skin maturity. And that can be tasted texturally. And you can look at the seeds, you can chew a grape, spit the seed into your hand and have a look at it and sort of see where it's at.
So when it came to harvesting your two whites that you've already picked so far, did you know from a couple weeks off your target date? Was that accurate?
I judge my target dates on what's happened in the past and over 20 years. So you can sort of get a sense of, when things should be happening. But that being said, you can be sort of within a 3-week window as well, depending on the year. And so I have an idea of when it's going to be, but I'm not always 100% certain. Those curveballs like rainfall or smoke in the valley, things like that are unpredictable and they can change the ripening quality as well.
We've been having bad smoke out here pushing up from Washington. I'm assuming it's been the same in the Okanagan. How has that impacted your harvest?
We have had the smoke, but only for the last, maybe 7 to 10 days, I have to guess, or so, mm-hmm. maybe 2 weeks. And, you know, on days it is very dense smoke. It seems dense, just blocking out the sun. I believe it definitely has affected the change in the sugar values. So we're not getting the same UV light necessary to ripen the grapes quite as quickly. Mm-hmm. For my whites, it hasn't really impacted too much other than slowing things down. My reds have been impacted a little bit more, especially because we started off the season with long, wet, and cool period up until finally in July, sort of getting some heat back that would be more characteristic of our summers.
Will you try to pick them later in the season then to compensate?
That's what I'm hoping for. Sometimes you can use water to stress a vine a little bit, but you have to be careful when and how you stress the vines to try to push them a little bit harder and sort of say, hey, winter's coming. Let's get it done here. I'm optimistic, you know, as a farmer should be, that we're going to get the right weather in a timely fashion and the grapes will do their part. So I'd love to have another, 3 to 4 weeks. But as we know, living in Canada, and not always the case, but I'd say over a 20-year period, it's more often the case that we don't get those frost events until the latest in late October or early November.
Mm-hmm. What would be the average time that you'd usually pick your last red wine grape?
Oh, between the 21st of October and the end of October.
Hmm, right. Is there any particular varietal that you're really looking forward to working with from this 2020 season?
I always love working with the Merlot and the Malbec. Actually, you know, I do love working with all the varietals. I love to experiment, and I'm often trying a new yeast or doing, you know, dividing a batch of grape juice into a couple different tanks and then trying a new yeast and then, you know, seeing what my result is and either blending that with what I would do traditionally or deciding next year I might do it all with a certain yeast because yeast really can drive flavor profiles. So I'm gonna play around a little bit with my Gewurztraminer demeanor. I decided I would pick it with a little bit different characteristics than sometimes usual. Hmm. So that's kind of fun. My Sauvignon Blanc, you know, people are enjoying it. And so I'm going to do that very similar to in past years. And we'll see where the Malbec comes in. My rosé has been quite popular. So I'd love to make more of that always, but I'm always a little bit limited by my quantity of Malbec. So if anybody listening has more Malbec, come talk to me.
To what degree do you figure out what wines you're going to make after you've harvested the fruit? And to what degree do you plan that out from the beginning of the season, you know, well before you harvest?
I think the majority of wines are planned long before the season and before harvest, but harvest dictates the final say on the style. I think a lot of happens for me while I'm making the wine this season and thinking about it over the winemaking period and then into the fall. I'm thinking about what I want to do for next year. And sometimes I get an idea that, you know, I want to try something new and something different. And then I put it into place for the next season.
That makes sense. Now, Ted, as sort of an independent, basically self-made winemaker, is there anything that you wish that you could see more of in the British Columbia wine industry?
I would love to see a school dedicated to viticulture and winemaking out here, other than we do have some great programs in our local colleges and stuff, but maybe a degree program similar to Brock University out here, I think, you know, would be great to see in our future. And I'd like to see just more people experimenting with new grape varietals. I think that, you know, when you look around the world, there's so many grape varietals that are still just unheard of to people here, and they continue to pop up from time to time and then become the new thing. And I think there's so much more to learn about grape varietals and, you know, what could really do well here and as good or better than what we've got going. I'd be excited to try some of that too.
When you go and actually pick up a bottle of wine for yourself, what do you like to drink?
I often will experiment with, you know, something that would be complementary to something, a wine that I might like to make. Like, for example, if I'm going to pick a rosé during rosé season, I love to see what different grape varietals can do for a flavor profile and some that I may not have tried. So I like to try other what other guys are doing, especially, you know, guys in British Columbia who grow either in my area or anywhere in British Columbia.
It sounds like when you drink wine, it's a little bit of work. It's research. I very rarely drink a bottle of wine now without studying it. I don't drink wine casually anymore. It's something that is inextricably linked up with my job, and I can't really separate that. Do you find that? Do you find that you have a hard time just sitting and drinking a glass of wine without thinking about it or examining it?
I do the same thing. I will always think about it and analyze it. But I think that so much about a great wine is often who you're pairing it with or what you're pairing it with sometimes. That'll make an experience that sort of elevates the wine as well. You know, it's a tough job we have, but someone's got to do it, you know, tasting wine and as part of our work. You know, I enjoy that part a lot as well.
Now, I mean, this is jumping way back to the beginning, but what made you become so fascinated with wine in the first place?
I was just one of those youngsters, I suppose. I was around 17 or 18. My family had always enjoyed wine. My parents were drinking wine and so on. Special occasions, I could try wines out. I don't know that it was all that appealing at the time, but I was also a kid with a chemistry set and looking for a practical application for that chemistry and meeting other characters along the way, like an uncle of a friend of mine who would make wine in his basement. And there's so much energy and ambiance to that situation. So I got pulled into that world and then started reading and just got fascinated and then always looking for that better product that could make the better wines and always looking for something better, perfection.
Mm-hmm. If there was something about wine making that you could teach the public about, what would that thing be?
One of the things that always interests me and I think is so important, and people don't necessarily think about it, but part of your terroir, well, terroir is so important, growing on different soils and how it can impact the wines. But over and above that, I think water is so important. Water is the bulk of a grape and grape juice. And so terroir should also include water. Imparting the right amount of water at the right time is so important to the final product. And for us growing in the South Okanagan, where we're growing in a desert, you know, we have the luxury and the consistency that comes with imparting the right amount of water at the right time. You know, Mother Nature kind of does a little bit, but, you know, we can override that for the most part. And that's probably one of the very most important things. And I love to talk about that and show that to people.
Well, I don't want to keep you too long. What are you doing today? Are you taking the day off or what are you working today?
I wanted to go and collect another sample of grapes this morning. So before this chat, I was out sampling some grapes. Did some analysis on them to sort of see where I'm at. I've got some work in the cellar. I'm just working on clarifying my Gewürztraminer juice that was just picked. So I'll inoculate with a yeast probably first thing this morning. And that's probably it. Hopefully take a bit of a break and enjoy the sunshine.
Well, I don't want to keep you from that much longer, but is there anything else that you wanted to say? Any last comments for anybody who's listening to this?
Well, thank you very much for the interview. And anybody who's listening, if you haven't had a chance to come down to Riverstone, I would welcome you. We've got a great staff and a great team. And I think that's all part of what we're trying to achieve here at Riverstone.
All right. Thank you so much, Ted. I appreciate you talking to me today. And I hope you have a great day and also a great remainder of the season. Great harvest for the rest of your fruit there.
Thanks very much.
Take care.
Yeah, you too.
Thank you all for listening to Uncork the Sun today with me and Ted. And thank you again to Riverstone for providing the coupon code for free shipping. That's, once again, UNCORK, all uppercase. And the coupon only lasts until the end of September, so order your wine now to save on shipping. I just tested the coupon code myself, and it even applies to other provinces. Ted probably won't actually want me saying this, but you could save a huge amount of money if you live out of province. That comes to a $60 discount if you live in Nova Scotia. I'm talking to you, Jeff Sampson. To learn more about Riverstone and the other wineries of Oliver and Assoyous, the best place to go is www.oliverassoyous.com. Now, just as we're rounding out the season for this podcast, we are also airing our season's final installment of the Virtual Vinstitute Live Tastings next Tuesday, September 29th at 7 o'clock p.m. Pacific Time on the Oliver Assoyous Wine Country Facebook page. If you've been enjoying listening to this podcast but you haven't watched the live show yet, set an alarm right now to remind you to tune in next week because this is your last chance. Now, all the live streams do continue to be watchable on the Oliver Assoyous Wine Country Facebook page after the fact, so please go back and watch all the previous sessions. But there's something particularly satisfying about being right there in the moment. Make sure you catch it. If you've been a fan of this podcast or of the live streams, please let us know. Right now, of course, we're shoring up both the series for the fall and the winter, and we're evaluating when or how to bring them back. So if you want to show your support and let us know that you want more Vinstitute, either make a post with the hashtag UncorkTheSun or email me directly at moss@vinstitute.ca with all your gushing praise. The music for this episode, as always, was provided by Olav. To hear more of his work, visit olav.bandcamp.com. And the host has been me, Moss Sherkogel, wondering just how much of my kids shouting you could hear in the background of this episode. I really tried to edit it all out. Whether you are experiencing the beauty of Oliver Osoyoos Wine Country from the comfort of your home, or whether you're planning a trip here for the future, as always, we cannot wait to raise a glass with you and uncork the sun together.